Russ trained and ran a 5K turkey trot injury-free by following the advice in a book called Born to Run. He's going to tell us all about it, and of course we'll have all of our regular features today on episode 82 of Fat to Fit Radio.
Welcome to Fat to Fit Radio, your source for real weight loss solutions without the hype. And now, here are your hosts, Jeff Ainsley and Russ Turley.
Hello and welcome to Fat to Fit Radio. So Russ, you are now an official turkey trotter. So how did this 5K race go back on Thanksgiving?
Well, it went very well. I had a goal of, I think it was between 10 and a half and 11 minutes. I was trying for that and I broke that. I did very well. I was just a little over 10 minutes per mile. So went out much faster than I should have. I was following the pack. And right about the halfway point, I was looking at the time, the split, and it was like less than 10 minutes per mile. I thought, I'm going to explode if I keep at this pace. And I was just following one person that whole time. And finally, they kind of slowed up, and I passed them. I'm like, okay, I need to find somebody else. That's when I realized I was going too fast. And I slowed down, so got about a 10-minute pace and finished in just a little over 30 minutes, 31 minutes and 9 seconds. So it was a really good race.
Well, that's excellent. Can you imagine doing that race carrying an extra 70 pounds like you used to weigh?
Oh, I could not imagine doing that. I watched a couple people, and there was one woman. She was, I was on the way back after the turning around point, and she was kind of walking slash running, and she was extremely large. And she looked like she was going to die. She was out of breath. And if you listen to her last show, you know, describing these people with the lungs around the neck and the fat pushing up on her lungs, I can imagine that's what her body was feeling like. You know, she was just gasping for breath. I thought, you know, tell her you don't have to finish. I mean, she went a long way. She went about a mile and a half in the race, but she was hurting. And there were a lot of people that were really struggling. I thought, you know, it feels good to be out here and running and not having to stop. And 70 pounds, dropping that weight really made a difference.
Well, one can only hope when you see really large people in races that this is the start of their journey. And a couple years from now, they will just be in perfect, awesome shape.
Right. Yeah. That was, you know, good on them for getting out there and doing that. You know, I had my Fat to Fit Radio t-shirt on. Hopefully somebody saw that and, you know, thought, hey, what is that? And looks into it. But yeah, you know, everybody's got to start somewhere. A year ago, I tried to run and hurt my knee. And now, so many pounds later, you know, did the 5K race and looking forward to my next race.
Well, that was just a great accomplishment for you. How did you do in the weight department since the last show?
Well, we did have Thanksgiving in the meantime. And so I am the same weight approximately that I was during the last show. So I haven't had any weight loss, but call this a non-scale victory week. You know, we've talked about those things that are not happening on the scale, but you're feeling better, you're losing inches and such, but yeah, running the race, non-scale victory. So I'm happy. We're going to get back to the weight loss, but right now it's just didn't happen.
Okay, well, we're all going to look forward to hearing about some weight loss for the next show then.
Well, I hope there'll be some weight loss too. But meanwhile, we've got some emails and some comments to talk about. The first one is from Tamara. She wrote here, "Hi guys, I love your podcast. Thank you for everything you do. You are both wonderful examples to me of how to live healthier. I came across this today and thought you would find it interesting given that we're going into holiday family season." And she's got a link here to a New York Times article.
That's right. And this is a really good article that talks about the holiday season in general and the pressures and conflicts that can arise when families get together and they eat together. And it's entitled Food, Kin, and the Tension at Thanksgiving. But it applies to the entire holiday season. Now, it is a fairly short article, so we're essentially going to read through most of the article. And when we do, think of how many times these situations seem familiar to you. And I'll just start off here. What side dish would you prefer to accompany your turkey? A serving of well-marinated conflict over how much or how little you eat? Or some nice fresh criticism of your cooking skills? As families gather around the country this week to celebrate the holidays, many of them are bracing for the intense emotions of the holiday meals. The combination of food and family often brings out long-standing tensions, criticisms, and battles for control. Simple issues like cooking with butter or asking for seconds are fraught with family conflict and commentary.
If we had an audio tape of a lot of families talking together, you wouldn't hear so much chatter about what other people are eating, who gained weight, who lost weight, who's eating like a bird, who's having seconds, notes Cynthia Bullock, director of the Eating Disorders Program at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Dr. Bullock told the story of a patient whose mother scolded her for not eating her homemade cookies. "You don't like my cookies," she asked. As a result, the daughter relented and took a cookie. But when she then reached for a second, her mother scolded her again. "Do you really think you need another one?" she asked her.
You know, that's really funny with family in that people get in these roles and they never really change. The parent is still the parent and is still criticizing and trying to guide. And as the children grow up, they're still now starting to fight back. I think that's just kind of a dirty thing. But it continues on here. In another family, a mother-in-law agreed to show up for Thanksgiving only if she could be assured that none of the foods would be prepared with butter. "I'm not doing butter right now," she said. "If you do butter, I'm not coming."
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, when these people go on diets or their whatever fad thing they're into, they, you know, they put those things on other people. And those, whatever it is, we've had a woman come to Thanksgiving and she doesn't eat turkey, so we have to cook a chicken breast or something for her. It's unreasonable to expect somebody to bend to your every whim if you're not doing butter or something like that this holiday.
That's right. And worst comes to worst, it's just one day or one meal. I mean, you can kind of go with the social pressure that's not going to hurt you in the long term.
Right. We'll continue on here. A Long Island woman who, like others interviewed for this column, didn't want to be named, said she and her family traveled 12 hours by train for a summer vacation gathering with her husband's family. When her husband asked for seconds, the sister-in-law said there wasn't any more food. "There was all this food around, but she had cut us off," the woman said. "We were just really shocked. We were being told you can't eat anymore after coming all this way. We found out later she really controlled the food in the household."
That's really interesting. And what the woman said, the reason was, and I'll just quote here, the woman said that in her own family, she faced a different problem, the pressure to eat more. During holiday meals, her son, who has never been a big eater, was constantly pestered about not eating enough. "There was a lot of pressure on him when he would visit my family," she said, "to try to get him to eat. My mother would say this terrible thing to him. She'd say, 'You know, you want to be a winner. You want to be a winner.'"
Yeah, so I don't know what he's winning there. He's winning some extra pounds this holiday. He's winning, you know, type 2 diabetes. He's winning high blood pressure in a few years. I don't know exactly what that mother was coming from. All right, I'll continue on here. A Boston physician said that in her household, holiday meals would inevitably lead to a food fight. Her father, a headache sufferer, had quit eating chocolate years earlier and became obsessed with stopping others from eating it, blaming chocolate for causing colds and other ills. "Both of my grandmothers liked to cook chocolate cakes," she said. "She would always get angry whenever they would offer him some, and he would not infrequently cause a scene. He would fly into a rage if he thought we had some chocolate."
That's just even worse than that person who would not eat any butter prepared with anything. You know, putting your own concerns onto everyone else, it really isn't too fair. What do you think?
Well, you know, it's like that person who comes to Thanksgiving dinner and they're now going on the Atkins diet. And so all they want to eat is turkey. And, you know, you can't have stuffing, you can't have potatoes or anything else because that's evil now. And they're going to tell you all about it. And meanwhile, next week when they're off it because they can't stand it, they'll eat all that stuff again.
I know. And they just kind of created a whole family scene just to, because they were on this new thing. But I'll continue on here. People who are overweight are particularly vulnerable to family criticism at holiday time. One person told the story of a mother-in-law who would prepare a huge holiday spread, then berate her overweight daughter for eating it. Holiday time is an extraordinarily difficult time for anybody with any kind of food issue. There are complex family relationships around eating.
But, you know, this is not all about conflict. Here's a positive suggestion from the article. If you know you have a family member with a tendency to criticize what others eat or don't eat, it might help to speak up about it and set some rules before the meal starts, Dr. Zerbe advised. Make a good-natured announcement that comments about how much or how little someone is eating are off limits, she said. Be prepared that the person won't stop talking about it. They can't. It's a form of control. But you have to battle that intrusiveness by putting up stronger family boundaries. Intervene and intervene again.
And it continues on. Betsy, a high school teacher in Boston, said she had long-standing issues with her mother-in-law, some of which began after she underwent a cesarean section. After the delivery, her mother-in-law, a slim woman, brought her only light bunches of lettuce salad, even though she was famished after nursing her baby. "Because of the incision, I couldn't go down the stairs to the kitchen," she said. "I called my husband at work, weeping, and asked him to come home and make me a peanut butter and jelly sandwich."
Yeah, there are a few times in life when you need to eat whatever your body tells you to. After pregnancy, nursing, those are good ones. When you're sick, nursing your body, getting your body back to 100%. Nobody needs to be dieting during those times. It's about getting the right foods in your body and not overeating, but putting in what you need. And a little salad after a C-section is not going to do it.
That's so true.
And here's one last possible strategy from the article. Betsy said her cousin also complained of holiday meal tension with her own family, so the two devised a strategy to help each other cope. Each made bingo cards, but instead of numbers, the squares were filled in with some of the negative phrases they expected to hear during the meal, like, "That outfit is interesting," or, "Your children won't sit still." As comments were made at the separate family celebration, each woman would mark her card. Whoever fills up a bingo row first, Betsy said, sneaks off to call the other and say bingo.
Well, you know, Russ, I found this to be a really interesting article. All these little scenarios that came up throughout. People have a lot tougher life than just saying, I'm going to go on a diet or a better eating strategy, and I'm going to start eating healthy, because there's all these things that come up, especially in the holiday seasons.
Yeah, there's a reason these holidays are stressful, and you know, these scenarios that we just heard are a part of that.
One of the things that came up a couple times about the person who doesn't like people eating chocolate or the person who doesn't want to eat any butter, I think little things like that, it's something that you can put up with for one meal a year. If you're eating 5 or 6 meals a day and you're going to have butter on some stuff, one meal out of thousands per year, it's not a big deal. Sometimes just sucking up a little bit of this for family is not going to hurt you in the long run.
Yep, I think that's good advice. We're going to get on to a voicemail from Teresa, and here she is.
Hey, Russ and Jeff. This is Teresa Bell calling from Forestville, Maryland, and I just wanted to let you know what happened to me this week while I was on the road, because as a traveling computer training, my energy is used up during the day teaching, and by the time I get to my next hotel, I'm a little beat and hungry, and tonight was no different, or was it? As I'm pulling into the parking lot of my hotel, I notice that there is this pancake restaurant adjacent to the hotel, and I just love, love, love pancakes. But I just don't feel like them, so I continue on, proud of myself for not succumbing to the temptation. So before just vegging out in front of the TV, the first thing I do is hit the hotel gym. Russ and Jeff are riding with me on the stationary bike with their podcast on staying motivated. I feel good about my choice to avoid the restaurant, again patting myself on the back. After the workout, I shower and change. The TV is noise in the background. And what commercial comes on? A commercial for some delicious-looking Eggs Benedict from that same pancake restaurant outside. One elevator down and a quick jog across the parking lot. Now what do? I'm weakening. Well, The Biggest Loser is on, so I'm watching that to get inspired. But I'm thinking about those Eggs Benedict. They're consuming my thoughts. I'm thinking about having some for breakfast tomorrow, so I'll have the whole day to burn it off. I'll work out in the morning. I'll walk around the block at lunch. I'll work out again when I get to my next location. But you know what? In the back of my mind, I'm thinking, who am I kidding? I'm not going to do all that working out. I hate to work out. I get to the restaurant website to see what kind of Eggs Benedict they have. They have all different types with delicious-sounding names like Over the Top, Country Cooking, and New Nolens Benedicts, which has Cajun chicken, succulent shrimp, hollandaise sauce. I can literally taste it. But then I see the link for the nutritional calorie counter. Ta-da-da-da. I am in shock. The brakes are on full force. These bad boys range in calories from 1,000 to 2,000 calories a serving, with over 4,000 milligrams of sodium. I immediately see my past week flurry before my eyes. How I wake up every morning at 5:45 to work out and hate it. How I say no to food that I really want. How all those decisions are really hard to make, but I make them every day because I want to be healthy. I don't like feeling unhealthy. I don't like feeling fat. I'm starting to like what I see in the mirror, and I like feeling healthy. 10 minutes of eating pleasure would equal hours of working out and many more hours of guilt. It just wasn't worth it to me. Next time, I'm just turning the channel on those types of commercials.
I really like this voicemail because we all have temptations, and this is just real life. This is what happens to all of us. And it's also so easy for us to give advice about how to eat and exercise perfectly, but we truly live in a messy and complex world just full of constant temptations.
Yeah, and I really liked how she said that she would eat there in the morning and not right now. You know, so many times that temptation, when you're first right there and it's pulling at you, if you can just say, you know what, I'll have that later. And then, you know, when you get back to it and you actually, you know, you're not hungry, or it's like going to the grocery store when you're hungry and all of a sudden your cart is full of a whole bunch of junk. If you can just put off till later, you'll find that temptation is gone. It's removed because you just had the willpower just to not eat it right then.
Well, that's true. And I think she was really good that she could admit to herself that she probably wouldn't do the extra working out if she had that meal. I know when people are really tempted, they'll say, of course I'll do an extra 1,000 push-ups and run an extra 10 miles. It'll be no problem because this is really going to be worth it. But when the craving is hitting you, people lie to themselves and they probably know that in reality, it's not going to happen.
And then she had a great line there in the voicemail. 10 minutes of eating pleasure would equal hours of working out and many more hours of guilt. Yeah, you know, she has to work out to eat, burn those calories. And she, like you said, Jeff, she probably wasn't going to do that. But then there's that, the psychological part, the, oh, I can't believe I ate that giant meal, and how guilty she felt or would feel if she had that meal. And that can do a lot more damage than just the meal itself.
Well, this is just like I was saying, this is real life. These are the temptations that are going to come across to everyone all the time. And I think the more of these that you can get over, you get stronger and you feel more proud of not succumbing to these temptations. And it does get a little bit easier.
All right, it's going to do it for our email and comments. I want to thank Tamara for sending in a link to that article. It was great. And for Teresa for calling in on the voicemail line. There are a few other ways you can get a hold of us. The first is by leaving a comment on our website at fat2fitradio.com.
Or you can send us an email to podcast@fattofitradio.com.
And just like Teresa, you can leave us a voicemail by clicking on the Call Me button on our website, fat2fitradio.com.
Or you can join our support group at fattofitsupport.com.
All right, now it's time to look at a couple of news items on the Web Report, and Jeff has an interesting one for us this week.
That's right. Now, this article that I'm going to talk about made international news everywhere. I found this on some Canadian sites, and then I did some research and found more links to American sites. And I'm going to link to startribune.com, and their article is entitled, Overweight Students at University in Pennsylvania Told to Take Fitness Class or Risk Diplomas. So Lincoln University is a university in which they test your BMI. And if you are obese, so your BMI is 30 or higher, they make you take a fitness class 3 times a week in order to graduate. Now, this is an interesting thing because the university is trying to fight the obesity epidemic, but they are singling out people who are overweight and making them take a class. And if they don't take this class, they don't graduate. Now, the university says they're just simply worried about the high rates of obesity and diabetes, and they know they're in the midst of an obesity epidemic, and they believe that they have an obligation to address this head on, knowing full well there's going to be some fallout. Now, this is the first group of seniors that are getting close to graduation, and there's about 80 people who have not been tested for their BMI, and some of them may not graduate because there might not be enough time for them to take this mandatory fitness class if they end up being obese. Now, the big concern here, and I'll just quote the article, if Lincoln truly is concerned about everyone being healthy, then everyone should have to take this gym class, not just people who happen to be bigger. So what do you think, Russ?
Well, I think it's interesting, though, that they're testing this, but I have to agree that just singling out those that are obese, if it's a requirement for the degree, you should have to take it. If it's a physical requirement on just those individuals, it's a little discriminatory. But, you know, I have no problem saying, okay, everybody has to take this class in order to be physically fit or at least know how to become physically fit. I think that's fine. Actually, when I was going to school, I went to Golden West College here in Huntington Beach near us, and there was a requirement if you're going to get your AA degree there, you had to take a physical fitness class, but everybody had to take it.
Well, I think their intentions are good, but the implementation is just not really workable. You can't make people take extra courses to graduate when someone else will not have to take it just because they are of a smaller size. I think it's a reasonable goal for everyone to take a physical education course and learn the basics of health and fitness. I have no problem with that. But I think they're really treading some thin water when they're singling out overweight people. But Russ, what do you have for us this week?
Well, this week I have an article here that was over on globalpost.com, and it is a list of the 10 fattest countries in the world. And I'm just going to go from number 10 to number 1 here, and you see if you can guess who's number 1, Jeff. So, number 10, the United Kingdom. 61% of the individuals are either obese or overweight. Next on the list, Croatia, 61.4. Israel, 61.9. New Zealand, 62.7. And Bosnia Herzegovina, 62.9. So we're getting up there. And now the top five. Egypt. I would not have guessed Egypt at 66%. It's very interesting. It says here, I always want to go here a little bit on Egypt. Egypt produced enough food to feed its people a steady diet of red meat, poultry, lentils, maize, and dairy products. But by the 1980s, the population had outgrown food production, leading to an increase in food imports that created poorer eating habits. And obesity among Egyptian women is particularly high, often attributed to cultural taboos on women exercising or playing sports. So not only that they are importing cheap foods that are making them fat, a lot of the women, because of whatever it is, the cultural things they're doing there, can't exercise. So that was interesting. I wanted to share that. Here, next on the list is number 4, Germany, at 66.5%. Those sausages from Germany, right, Jeff?
That's right.
All right, and here is my country, the United States. We've heard this number before, 66.7%. Two-thirds of Americans are too fat. And the numbers are going up, 6.7. We're going to be able to say 67% here shortly, Jeff, if people don't start listening to the show. Next one, and this is, now he just jumps up crazy amounts here. Number 2 on the list, Kiribati. 81.5% of the individuals on Kiribati, which is a Pacific nation, it's one of those islands, are obese or overweight. And the number 1, and this is also one of these Pacific islands, American Samoa. 93.5% of the population on American Samoa are overweight. And
that is just incredible. I mean, the life expectancy must be just be going down. That's something I want to look into to see how healthy the actual population is as a whole, because it's not even a 50%. This is almost 100% when you reach over 90% of the population being overweight.
Yeah, and I have to assume, just like the island nations and Egypt dimension, now more and more food is being shipped in that is just this high calorie, high sugar content foods. And instead of eating the native foods that are there, they mentioned some of those foods like yams, bananas, taro root, coconut, fish, that they're importing all this cheap food, and they've just embraced it completely. And now you've seen the results. 93.5% are overweight or obese. It's just incredible.
One thing, I'm surprised that Canada isn't in that list, because I know we're pretty close to the Americans, but I guess we just didn't quite fit the top 10.
Yeah, you know, apparently just Canadians have gotten a little more fit, or not as fat as fast.
Well, I think a lot of the fast food that you talk about in California, we don't have in Canada yet. It all gets here eventually, but generally we're 10 to 15 years behind you guys. And a lot of things like obesity, we're 10 to 15 years behind. But the way things are going, I'm sure we're going to catch up, unfortunately.
You can do it, Jeff. I know you can.
All right, let's move on to the feature section. And this week we are talking about a book that you just read, Russ.
This week here on the feature section, I'm going to be giving you my review of the book Born to Run by Christopher McDougall. Now, this seemed appropriate since I just victoriously finished my grueling 5K race on Thanksgiving. But actually, listener Rocky, who you might remember from our show on type 2 diabetes, sent over an email recommending Born to Run. Now, I had heard an interview with one of the people that the book was about, and it sounded great. I put it on the short list of books to read in the near future. But then when Rocky mentioned it was also an audiobook on Audible, it went straight to the top of the list. I spent pretty much every spare moment of a recent weekend listening to the book. So what's it all about? The author, Christopher McDougall, chronicles the running of a 50-mile ultra trail marathon race in the Copper Canyons of Chihuahua, Mexico. The race pits some elite American ultra marathoners against native Mexican people called the Tarahumara. These Tarahumara live in the Copper Canyons in caves and simple homes. They're also known as the Rarámuri, or the running people in their own language. During McDougall's telling the story of this race, he gives some backstories on all the participants of the race and all the events that lead up to them being there in the Copper Canyons. And he couldn't have created a more colorful set of characters if he had made them up. Now just check out some of these names. Caballo Blanco, It's the White Horse. Or Barefoot Ted. How about La Brujita Bonita, the Pretty Little Witch. Or Oso, the Bear. Or El Lobo Joven, the Young Wolf. And that's just the Americans. The Tarahumara have equally interesting names like Arnulfo Quimare, or Miguel Luna, or Matermando Cervantes. Now, McDougall also chronicles his own journey to becoming a runner. He saw multiple sports medicine doctors that all told him separately to, in essence, give up running and buy a bike instead. But he wouldn't take no for an answer. Here's a little clip of audio from the author, Christopher McDougall, that tells a little bit about the book in his own words. Now, we got this from the Amazon website for the book. You can check it out over on Amazon.com. Here is the clip.
I'm Christopher McDougall, author of Born to Run. About 3 years ago, I set out to solve the biggest mystery in modern sports. Why does my foot hurt? If you're a runner, and millions of us are, you're always hurt. 8 out of every 10 runners is hurt every single year. And this makes no sense. We have the best technology on the planet. We have sports podiatrists. We have sports medicine. And we have an endless rash of running injuries. And then one day I saw this picture in a magazine of a guy in a skirt and a pair of sandals charging down a Rocky Mountain. This was a Tarahumara Indian. He was 55 years old. He had just won a 100-mile foot race through the Rocky Mountains wearing nothing but a pair of homemade sandals. And what I couldn't understand is, how does he get away with it and I can't? How is it I've ripped my hamstrings and I've got Achilles tendonitis, I've got endless plantar fasciitis, and so does everybody else. But we have $150 running shoes that have been perfected with 30 years of engineering. So I ventured down to the Copper Canyon to see if I could find out how it is that the Tarahumara Indians, running in shoes that barely qualify as shoes, can run hundreds of miles into their late life and never get injured. What I discovered led me on the quest to write this book, Born to Run. What I found is that there are cultures around the world that have perfected the art of moving their body over wild terrain in their bare feet, and they do it in such a way that they never get hurt, that they enjoy, that they're liberated by it. So by the time I finished writing Born to Run, I felt that I had grasped the secret of the Tarahumara Indians, a secret that has been around for 10,000 years, which is the way that you and I are actually born to run.
So that's very cool. So doesn't that intrigue you? And yes, you'll find in this book a lot of information about the act of running, the mechanics of actually how to run so you don't get injured. In the author's own words, it's the reason the book was written. But I don't believe it's the reason why you should read this book. In the book, you'll also learn about persistence running. Native people from parts of the world would actually run down an antelope or a deer, not by sheer speed, but by being relentless and running for long distances. They would actually run after the deer until it literally drops dead. Also, one individual in the book actually gets to witness a persistence hunt, and it's fascinating hearing about it, and it's also not the reason to read this book. The book should be read because the stories of the individuals that make up the book are so fascinating. Every individual story or side story in the book is about running. Every individual story, you'll find inspiration. Obviously, I'm not going to retell all these stories here, but one in particular really stuck with me. It was about an ultra trail marathoner named Scott Jurek. Jurek is, and as far as I can tell, still is the man to beat in these types of events. As of the writing of the book, Jurek had won the Western States Endurance Run, it's a 100-mile race, 7 times in a row. That's impressive enough, but it was the retelling of when he ran the Badwater Ultra Marathon in Death Valley, California, that he really impressed me. Now, during the race, the air temperature can reach 126 degrees Fahrenheit. The highway surface that they run on can reach 190 degrees Fahrenheit, hot enough that they run on the white lines on the pavement to not melt their shoes. Now, in 2005, this was the first time Jurek had run this race. And at mile 60, not even halfway through this 135-mile race, on what would feel like the surface of the sun, Jurek collapsed, vomiting and shaking. He was well behind the leader and couldn't see that leader on the road in front of him anymore. Now, this was the impressive part. He told himself, you'd have to do something totally sick to win this thing. You'd have to run 80 miles as fast as you've ever run 80 miles in your life. And so he laid there for a few minutes, and then he got up and he did it. And he shattered the record for this Badwater Marathon by finishing it in 24 hours and 36 minutes. That is impressive. So, in the end, all the key characters in the book, including McDougall, head down to Mexico and compete in that 50-mile trail race against these running people, the Tarahumara. You have to read it for yourself to find out who wins. But when the race finally happens in the book, you realize, like I did, that it wasn't about the race, and it really wasn't about the act of running. It was about the journey that each person took to get there. So, just to sum up, if you are a runner, You will love this book to death. It is great. It will be your new once-a-year inspirational read. If you're not a runner, you will want to become one. It is that good. So, Jeff, did I entice you to pick up the book?
Well, this sounds really interesting. I like reading stories and things like this that are really inspirational. And I used to be so addicted to running. I love doing it, and I have a bad knee, so I had to give it up. But this sounds like a really good read. I'm definitely going to take a look at it.
Yeah, especially you say you have a bad knee. This book in particular was about a guy, McDougal himself, that started off because he had a bad knee. So I think for you, you know, I don't know that's going to fix your knee if it's something genetic or, you know, a deficiency in your knee in particular. But I know that I've been running in this technique, this kind of, you know, more 4-foot technique, and it's a little hard on the legs to begin with, but man, it feels good. And as, you know, I've been running injury free. So the book is a lot about that, but, like I said, the stories and the inspiration are way more important than the writing technique part.
Yeah, it sounds really good. So, Russ, what do you have for the recipe this week?
Well, part of the, a lot of the story in Born to Run talks about these Tarahumara Indians and their food that they eat. Particularly, there are two things that were always on their lips when they're eating or drinking. One was pinole, and that was a cornmeal-based product. And I found a website here for our recipe that how you make Tarahumara pinole out of the cornmeal, and they make either mix it up with a beverage or you can bake it and make these little pinole cookies, which is very cool. So you check that out. And the second one, which they mentioned, it had like magical properties that if you were totally just hurting and destroyed out on the trail somewhere, you would drink some chia fresca and you would be rejuvenated and you could run for hours and by drinking this chia fresca. So I also have a link for our recipe for chia fresca. And it's basically the chia seed and some lemon and some natural sweetener. But I've got my chia on order, went on the internet and found a place where you get it for about $4 a pound. So I'm going to try it out. I haven't got it yet. We're still waiting on that, but try it out and let us know how it is, because it just sounds amazing and with magical properties, like, you know, you can run all day drinking this chia fresca. I mean, how can you resist?
Well, you'll have to give us a report when you get that, Russ, for sure.
Yeah, I think it'll be one of those ones where I'm the only one in the house that tries it and everybody else is kind of looking at me with a strange look like, I'm not drinking that. But Jeff, what do we have for our homework this week?
Well, the homework this week has to do with planning ahead for holiday meals with family and friends. Oftentimes, when you're offered seconds, no is not taken seriously, and you are egged on or guilted into having another helping, or even worse, you are put in the position of justifying why you are refusing to eat more. The homework this week is to come up with 3 polite ways or excuses to tell people as to why you don't want any more food. For example, you could say, "No thanks, but it was extremely tasty and all the time you spent preparing it really showed." Or the classic, "No thanks, I'm feeling really full and want to save some room for dessert." Have these 3 lines ready to go so you're not put on the spot unprepared at any of these holiday meals.
That's good advice. Yeah, you can use those many, many times during this holiday season. So Jeff, what's our quote for this week?
The quote this week comes from Joel Osteen, and he said, "A dream without a plan is just a wish."
All right, very good. I want to thank everyone for listening to the show, for downloading, and take a look at those show notes if you want to get any of the recipes or check out the articles we discussed. They're over on the website at fat2fitradio.com. Just look for show number 82. And with that, we will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Send your feedback or questions to podcast at fattofitradio.com. For more information on today's show or any previous shows, visit the website at fattofitradio.com. If you would like to support the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast directory.